and welcome to Mindset, an HCD vidcast, where we dive into the world of applied consumer neuroscience and market research with leading experts in the field. My name is Michelle Nagella, PhD in behavioral neuroscience and Director of Research and Innovation at HCD.
And I'm Catherine Ambrose, the Manager of Behavioral and Marketing Sciences with HCD. As your hosts, we are going to act as the buzzkills for the buzzwords, taking time to critically think about the limitations and pitfalls of emerging trends and topics within the field to help you identify what innovation has a lot of untapped potential or is too good to be true.
Now, HCD is a full-service research house which provides research capabilities on consumers by looking at how they perceive, evaluate, and respond to different types of stimuli, such as looking at product experiences, communications, or just general consumer and shopper experiences. We use a combination of tools that come from psychology, physiology, neuroscience, as well as the traditional methods that people typically use to see how they experience different stimuli. That stimuli can range from the early stages of exploration all the way through the final product validation tests. This is what we refer to as applied consumer neuroscience.
So stick around for more curious conversations as we chat our way through the ever-evolving space of consumer science. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mindset. We are so happy to have you here with us today. It is your hosts, Catherine and Michelle, back again. We are really excited to be chatting with Anna Wexler today from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm so excited to have her on with us. She's been a friend of HCD for quite some time. So without further ado, I am going to introduce Anna. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
So glad to have you. I know we've said this to you before, but Catherine and I have always kind of fangirled over your stuff because we've had this conversation before. We really appreciate your take. You know, we've always been really concerned about people's use of and misuse of neuroscience equipment. And so coming across your work was really interesting to us. I know we've had
breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Yeah. So we would love to get to know you a little bit better. And within that, it's kind of like, how did you get here? Like, what's your origin story? What was your radioactive spider that kind of like drew you into maybe neuroscience or maybe like led you on that path towards neuroethics?
How did I get here? So it's a bit of a winding story, but I don't think it's that winding. So I think I've always been interested in the brain and how we think. And so I'll even, you know, go further back into the origin story to say that I grew up in a very Orthodox religious family. And so a Jewish Orthodox. And so I didn't share their beliefs as I realized that as a teenager. And so I was always interested in why people believe what they believe. And so I think that's what got me interested in the brain. And then I studied brain science as an undergrad. I knew I wanted to major in neuroscience, studied it as an undergrad, and I thought I wanted to be a neuroscientist. So I worked in neuroscience labs from like as a research assistant from my first semester in college.
What flavor of neuroscience was that? Was it with humans or?
Yeah, so cognitive neuroscience. So humans, fMRI, I did a lot of fMRI imaging. Some MEG, and maybe some EEG. Not really. I didn't really get into EEG at the time. So
the big equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the big equipment. Whole rooms of equipment. And so at the same time as I was doing that degree, I also really liked writing. I've always written, and so I actually ended up with two degrees: one in neuroscience and basically a writing degree. But I decided I didn't like the day-to-day of doing neuroscience research was really, you know, something that I didn't want to do. Like it was very, like the thing that was so fascinating to me about neuroscience was these larger questions of what it means to understand the brain and develop technology that can interface with the brain. And so I decided I wanted to stay in that world, but not be a neuroscientist because you don't really engage with those larger questions on a day-to-day basis.
The philosophical questions of neuroscience.
Exactly. And so I took a detour and became a neuroscience writer, essentially, or science writer and communicator. And I did that for a few years. I ended up moving to Tel Aviv in Israel. Did my long origin story. At the same time, I was also began work as a documentary filmmaker. So I was basically doing films and also writing. And then, you know, when you write,
okay, so wait, tell us a little bit about these films.
So I made a feature documentary called Unorthodox. That was my main film. So that's not the Unorthodox on Netflix. And that's not my Unorthodox life, which I think is on Netflix or maybe a different channel. There's two new Unorthodoxes. Mm-hmm.
You were the original.
I was the original Unorthodox. And actually people said, like, what do you think that these other Unorthodoxes came out? And actually we've gotten like a bump in views, like actually bumps in views every time a new Unorthodox comes out.
So you're like, yay.
And Amazon Prime, like, we're not, you know, Netflix has, do you guys know the Unorthodox show? Have you seen that?
I've heard of it. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Anyway, Netflix has it. So Amazon Prime, we're on Amazon Prime. So Amazon Prime would feature us prominently because we're Unorthodox, but we're not the Unorthodox that people were searching for. But, you know, we got a nice bump in all our views.
That is so cool. I feel like it also just the topics of the storytelling that you were doing, it involves storytelling, but obviously unorthodox. And you kind of touched a little bit on how you grappled with your views on ethics versus the views that you may have been exposed to. So it really does seem like those things kind of, those formative years really shaped where you ended up inevitably looking into neuroethics, which I find really, really interesting. You had a little bit of foreshadowing going on in your own life as you became a storyteller.
Yeah, I think so.
So what brought you back to academia from documentary making?
So I would say two things. I think the main thing was that when you're working as a science writer, you're writing about other people. And I loved, which was really fun. You know, I loved meeting scientists. I love hearing about their work. I loved getting to find out like what they were working on that wasn't published yet and asking them about the big questions. Right. So in a sense, I still could get the things that I missed, but, you know, or what I really enjoyed, right. Those things that I really enjoyed about science. But I missed the ability to do my own work, my own research, because you're mostly getting assigned what the editors want, or you have to pitch what editors want. Mm-hmm. So, I decided to apply for a PhD. And I only applied to one program and luckily I got in, but I enjoyed what I was doing in Israel, and I had an little apartment, a little studio right on the beach.
Wow.
Like, I was enjoying myself. but I got into this program. I was also I did my undergrad at MIT, and then this PhD program was at MIT, and it was in science, technology, and society. So it was, you know, I was able to sort of draw on the neuroscience work, the neuroscience world that I've been involved in, but I was able to sort of ask these bigger questions and do that within the PhD program. So look at larger social issues, but also have sort of a foot in the door, you know, with neuroscience.
Would you mind giving a few examples of those larger questions within neuroethics that you like to focus on and that you find yourself daydreaming about?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, during the PhD, so I did my PhD on the do-it-yourself brain stimulation community, which was a group of people who basically like were reading non-scientists who were reading scientific experiments about these like stimulation devices. So low levels of electrical stimulation. So basically batteries with wires, 9-volt batteries, and you could just make one pretty simply and put it on your head and give yourself a little jolt of current. And so there was this movement that arose, or people were reading that scientists were doing it, and so they started doing it themselves. So they were replicating the same devices that scientists were using in a laboratory.
Which is truly fascinating because it sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the reality is it's very low levels of current. So one question is, how terrifying is it? Right. And there was a debate about, like, I mean, to put it another way, like, what are the harms? Right. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of ethical debate about, you know, what are the harms, you know, of this sort of brain stimulation, you know, how should policy, or I should say, should there be policy or regulation to deal with those harms? How should the scientific community react to people using these devices at home? And then just for me, so those are some of the questions that I found really interesting. But it was also fascinating that people had done this, right? Like they could find the information that they wouldn't have been able to find like 15, 20 years ago.
True.
If, you know, there wasn't the internet.
And then there's the why they're doing it, right? So they're hoping to have some sort of positive effect.
Yes. So are they doing it for enhancement? Are they doing it to self-treat a disorder? So actually I ended up studying this community using sociological methods and then understanding what they were using it for and how. So that was a large part of my PhD, was understanding this community.
That is so interesting, especially because you kind of think about when you were talking about what kind of harm does it have, you kind of, and you touched on this again, when you were saying, what is the purpose of it? Why are you feeling the need to have this stimulation, this brain stimulation, whatever is motivating you for it? If you do it too much, are there long-term effects of this? It's a brand new, you know, gadget. People really don't know, and you won't know because it's long-term. So it's, you know, having those debates, and you're kind of doing that in real time, it seemed like, and you almost had a fight against the advancement of technology then.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting about that question is A, there was really no, well, two things. One, I actually found in my research that the way that people differed from the way that lay individuals, these DIY folks, right, differed from the way that scientists were using it, is that they did use it long-term. Whereas in scientific experiments, it would be like usually once or twice or three, you know, like a few times, whereas they would use it chronically. Mm-hmm. And there was no data on the long-term use, which is really interesting. And, you know, people started asking like, well, shouldn't there be data on long-term use? And, you know, and there isn't. But also what's interesting about that is that any drug or or medical device that goes through FDA and gets approved, there often isn't long-term studies prior to approval,
sure.
Not much afterwards. So the whole system, the way we think about what's considered safe, right? Safety is measured as really as this like a short-term adverse event, something that you can measure and really connect it directly to the first, to let's say a stimulation event or something like that, mm-hmm. right? The system is not really set up to look at long-term events, which is itself like, I think,
especially in maybe a clinical population where you have people that might be self-treating.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, I don't want to stray too far down this path, but it also makes you think about where the focus is, especially when with the ramifications of those things, it's on the reactive instead of the proactive. And, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and the focus is on, all right, well, now this person had this high voltage or whatever for way too long. And now they have, I don't know, yeah. some crazy thing in their brain. It's kind of picking up the pieces afterwards.
Low levels of damage that maybe build over time or yeah. who knows. But it's interesting because there probably is, I would imagine when you get communities like this and you have a lot of communication within a community, and I assume that's what would happen here, like a Reddit type of community mm-hmm. of support network. And it's almost like citizen science combined with that. I mean, we live in a society now where people, any person can decide to do home renovations and learn everything they need to on YouTube, right? You can mm-hmm. just replace your entire kitchen if you want based on YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these things are possible, and it is possible that they were being very cautious and careful.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is actually what I found in my work, that they actually were being very cautious and careful. And, you know, in contrast to people who had, scholars who had said, oh, these people are just being reckless and stupid, you know, I actually went to build a device, you have to have a certain level of intelligence, yeah. right? Yeah. And to think about where to stimulate. So I found that, yeah, these people were actually, for the most part, right? You know, I would say for the most part, well-informed, not everybody, but, you know, right. a lot more well-informed than people had given them credit for. And they were also like, they weren't rejecting science. They were hanging on every word that the scientists were
right.
writing and putting out. And so the way to communicate with them, and this is something I advocated for, was sort of an open engagement approach. Like, look, these people are like hanging on every word you scientists are saying. Like,
there's power there. Yeah.
Yeah. Right to them. You know, they're not rejecting you. They're, mm-hmm. you know, and there are implications for scientists too, right? To understand that. So when scientists write and when scientists publish, they're sort of imagining this audience in their head, you know, and I do this when I publish too. Like, I mostly write to other neuroethicists. That's who I imagine is my imagined audience that's reading the paper, like even you know, I'm not thinking about that as I'm writing, but, you know, subconsciously or unconsciously, right? And so it was very interesting because scientists write for other scientists, but then they have this like unintended audience that was just reading on everything they wrote, essentially, right? And so I would give talks to scientists, just sort of raising of their awareness of this fact, right? That they had this unintended downstream audience.
That makes absolute sense, especially because, like you were saying, your audience, even if you're focusing on neuroethic, like other neuroethicists, I can't speak, you might also have two random HCD employees taking a peek at it and being and really fascinated.
That's the same problem or same issue we see in, you know, consumer neuroscience, let's call it, from our, you know, standpoint of being a market research, right? Where mm-hmm. the problem in, you know, quote unquote neuromarketing is that the same thing was happening where marketers were taking sort of esoteric academic research and trying to apply it to studying consumers mm-hmm. interacting with ads. So, you know, seeing a study that did, you know, used EEG to look at cognition and then saying, oh, we can do the same with people watching TV, even though it is a pretty big leap, you know, even in the way you're talking about where these DIYers were, you know, using the stimulation for long periods of time. Again, that academic study is very acute and very designed in very specific way that doesn't always apply to the real world, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we saw the same thing, except maybe a little more unethical, I would say, in where in the neuromarketing realm, people were trying to sell something. And I guess that leads us to another topic of conversation where, you know, for us, we saw a lot of people trying to sell using methodologies in ways that weren't necessarily the best way. And I think there is an effort to improve upon that. But you see sort of the same thing where people might actually be creating products to market for home use, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what started out in this space as, you know, and again, my own work started out being focused on the neurostimulation device space, right? This people making their own devices, but that quickly turned into, right, entrepreneurs started mm-hmm. Actually creating devices for people who didn't want to make them themselves. And then you had more well-funded companies getting into the game, you know, with some more significant startup funding and things like that, and selling, you know, wearable devices. So instead of having to create the device with wires, right, you could just take it out of the box, hook it up to, you know, put it on your head, hook it up to phone. And so there, like you said, there's somebody selling something, right? So it's not just someone doing something at home for their own personal purpose, right? You have a company or an individual selling a product with some sort of claim about what this device can do.
Which makes it much more dangerous, right? Because now you have claims that are being marketed. What is the FDA regulation on things like that? Because I know, like in the supplement space, making claims about improving memory is pretty hazy, right? So what's mm-hmm. what's going on with these devices you can purchase?
So it's complicated, is the bottom line. But so far, these devices, FDA has not taken any action. Any regulatory action against these devices. I would say some of them, the ones that there are some out there that market themselves for medical purposes. And, you know, looking at FDA and FDA law and how the FDA definition of a medical device is set up, marketing yourself as a medical device. So saying this device can cure your depression or improve your symptoms right. of depression, that makes you a medical device. Mm-hmm. But those devices are out there. The FDA hasn't taken action. So those are illegally marketed medical devices. It gets more complicated when you talk about wellness devices or devices marketed for relaxation and stress, memory improvement, right? There, the FDA has basically said that it's going to look the other way for devices that are low risk and only marketed for wellness.
Now, that's interesting. Yeah.
What low risk means and what wellness means mm-hmm. are two questions that the FDA hasn't, I mean, they've given some indication of what they think each one means. So wellness is just sort of general claims. So if you're not using, you know, if you're not saying cure depression, cure or relieve insomnia, but you're saying optimize your brain function, right? That's like a right. lighter. So the FDA is probably
play around with the wording a little bit,
which is exactly what supplement makers do. So yeah. if you look at the wording of supplement claims, they oh, can't yeah. they can't say that they're going to treat or cure. You know, they're very careful, right? Mm-hmm. If they do, yeah. then suddenly they're a drug, and they're a drug that's being marketed in violation of FDA law. So so similarly, we see those sort of wellness claims. The question is, what's a low risk device? So right now it seems like the FDA thinks that the recording devices, so devices that use EEG but don't provide any stimulation, it seems like FDA is thinking of those as low risk, but devices that provide some electrical stimulation, not as low risk. Mm-hmm. So still there are neurostimulation devices out there that make wellness claims, but the FDA has not actually taken action against those either.
Yeah. I'm thinking specifically about certain products, especially with, like you were saying, in the EEG space that focus on things like they will pair EEG with meditation and mm-hmm. say, this will help your meditation practice.
Like and feedback.
Then,
yeah.
Yeah. And they'll say it through the feedback, but also then they'll provide all this research about how meditation as a practice is good for you. And that's kind of their way of skating around how this technology.
Because they never did the clinical study to prove that they're having a real effect. Yeah.
Exactly. But so I do think
that in EEG, and we also see companies, right, saying that this works, right? So they haven't done the studies, right? So they'll either point to different literature, like you said, like not exactly literature that they should be pointing to. They'll point to literature done on research grade EEG devices. So not their electrode devices, and say, look, this has been proven, or they just won't have anything at all. So there's very little, if any, data to support many of the claims that's a lot of the consumer EEG companies are making.
And that's what made us so interested in your work, because we see so much of that in the quote unquote neuromarketing space, where again, they extrapolate from a clinical grade EEG headset and, you know, they have this one electrode or two electrode headband that they're saying the person can walk freely in a store and we can anticipate what their decision-making would be. So it's just a huge jump, a huge leap. But, you know, it's so attractive because people hear EEG and they automatically think, you know, mind reading, and that we can somehow peer into the brain or manipulate the brain very easily.
But I think what's so interesting about the different spaces, right, is that in my world of direct-to-consumer devices, the companies are marketing publicly to consumers. So I can like go on these websites and analyze the claim. But in your world, it seems more hidden in some way, right? You'll have a generic storefront. I don't know what it is, but
they're
not claiming to do certain things. Maybe unless you sit down and have an actual like meeting with them, the claims don't seem to be as public. Or is publicly available. I don't know if that's.
Yeah, it depends which public you're in, right? So we get to hear it all the time where we hear interesting things like actual numbers where they'll say something like 90% of all decision-making is subconscious, which is a really interesting statement because it has a very specific number, which makes you think that there's an academic study.
Right, that we know exactly how much, what even how to quantify what is a decision.
And therein lies the problem, right? Where you find out that no, there is no study. There's no study indicating 90%, but also how could you even decide what's unconscious and conscious? But the person who's interested in this type of marketing, you know, this is being marketed to, meaning market researchers and marketing people in marketing departments that are trying to design ads, et cetera, they don't know that because they don't have that experience from learning psychology or neuroscience to understand that there's no measure. There's really no line, mm-hmm. Because we hear people always talking about system one and system two, coming from Kahneman, as though they're really separate entities in the brain that are conscious and non-conscious. It's very difficult if you aren't an expert, that you don't have like this education to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we've seen this across different areas, but when information sounds scientific, it always carries more of an appeal. And so we've seen that in neuroscience, and those are studies that found that. It's not another system one that's like backed up in various, by studies done in different areas. And I teach a class this semester on, it's called Social Media, Digital Health and Bioethics, and we were teaching about misinformation. Mm-hmm. And so I was teaching about some of the misinformation studies and the influence of misinformation. And so this one study that I was teaching also found that when it was about misinformation in the COVID context, so that the most persuasive messaging, factually incorrect messaging, was that which appealed to science. So if you have like a graph or something that claims to show something.
Yeah, or you use science words.
Yeah. Right. Data visuals being skewed or something like that. But is this conversation around what is being appealed to their audience? It's really interesting to me, especially because market researchers shouldn't have to know everything about the brain to have to trust, you know, what they're purchasing and what, like, they are putting trust into the vendors or whoever it is they're going to provide that accurate information. Because like I said, if you are coming from a background in advertising, why should you have to know all about the brain to, you know, decide if you want to use this
there
product?
There is trust there, which is the same thing. If someone's buying a product that's being mass produced, like, you assume that proper testing has been done and that it really is doing what it's doing. There's not anything odd is going to happen to you or anything like that. So if you buy one of these headsets, but I guess another interesting thing, another ethical issue there is if you have these headsets that are being bought, and this is, you know, kind of a parallel issue can happen in market research as well. And it is sort of the reason there are certain laws that have been made about market research using neuroscience is the idea of privacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like owning your data. So if you are uploading your EEG data into your, you know, cell phone, into your mobile device, so that this company can give you feedback. So what's going on in that space?
So I would say it's totally blurry, you know, in terms of ownership, who owns the data, and then especially what happens to the data afterwards, right? After the company collects it, is it being sold? Is it being used? You know, I don't think the data is very, so I think it's an issue. I don't think that currently that data is very revealing, especially when
it's not terribly useful right now.
Not terribly useful, and especially when you don't have the contextual information
around
it, right? Like, this is just the raw EEG. So so for me, I see it as part of the larger problem of like lack of data protection,
lack of regulation.
Lack of regulation around data protection, especially in the US as compared to Europe, where there's more careful attention to data privacy and data protection.
I think that kind of takes us into like the next evolution of this, which when we've spoken about this before, I always thought your take was really interesting, because my initial gut reaction when I hear that companies like Facebook or Google or Apple or, you know, Elon Musk are interested in neuroscience and making gadgets that can, you know, actually maybe be inserted into your brain or be able to predict, you know, what you want to text, right? Things like that. My initial reaction is always like a big eye roll, because I'm just like, oh, you know, these people getting in this space, you know? But one take that I thought was really interesting from you once is that you were saying that the good thing about it is when there's interest in money being injected into learning about the brain, that can be a really good thing.
Yeah. So I think especially I'm not sure if it's been in one of our conversations, but yeah, I think it could be a really good thing in terms of sort of unintended beneficiary. I think Musk is investing in neurotech because he wants to, I mean, and he said this, it's not just what I think. I mean, he said he wants to, you know, merge humans with AI, and, you know, that's his goal, to have this consumer device, right? But he's investing a lot of money. The way he has to do that, right? He can't just do that, because that wouldn't work. From a regulatory perspective, they have to start in the medical space. So he's sort of by regulatory necessity is investing a lot in the medical space for brain computer interfaces. And so when you throw a lot of money, like Elon Musk level money, right, at some engineering problems that are real in the brain computer interface world, you will see benefits. I mean, it's hard. You will, most likely. And so, you know, I think it's going to be the surgeons who are going to benefit from this, right? It's going to be, well, mostly the patients, neurosurgery practices, I think, will improve from his investment, making things probably more safer and potentially less invasive for patients on who need neurosurgery. And I think, you know, I think patients in a variety of spaces likely stand to benefit. In an unintended
right. Yeah. It's not for their reasons are not entirely altruistic.
Exactly. It's funny because earlier this week, I just shared with Michelle an article about how Elon Musk with the Neuralink is being, it's a little bit under fire because a group of medical people are suing UC Davis, who are the people that conduct all the research for Neuralink, and it's funded by Neuralink. They're suing due to ethical issues in regard to all of, they're doing animal testing and quite a lot of the
15 out of 23 monkeys died, I think.
It was
striking because it, you know, on the one hand, like you were saying, I think it's great because it generates enthusiasm and it generates money and research, but then there's a risk, right? But something so high profile, like Elon Musk getting involved, is when something goes wrong, then everybody sees that something went horribly wrong. So here, something horribly has gone wrong. The majority of the participants died. And clearly that might equal to a lot of people, oh, neuroscience bad, or brain computer interface bad.
Right.
And so that's the risk.
Not human participants.
Yes, they're not human, primates. But yeah, the majority of them, you know, when you have 15 out of 23, that those are bad numbers. Right. And so, yeah, you know, that's not a good look.
Right. Yeah. It really does become a discussion about if, you know, is no news good news, or is it better to be like upfront and say, okay, this type of research is going out there. But I do agree with you that the indirect benefits of having funding in here is that we will get knowledge somehow, some way. This research will tell us something because we have the brightest and the greatest minds all having the opportunity to even focus on the topic at hand. You know, unfortunately, these primates didn't reap the benefits of that information, but it is at least a step in some direction. You know, even if
because the engineering tools, like you said, are just improving exponentially because of the effort, right? Which is great.
And furthermore, you can even argue that, again, not to the primates' advantage, but if this brings about new change for ethical advances to be made for reevaluating how research is being done in the animal space, that's another, you know, it's a byproduct of this high profile research that's going on, which, you know, it's really interesting. I do have a question for you that it's a little bit of a change of topic, but you touched on it once with us and I wanted to revisit it. Is there ever a point where you think that you personally would be interested in using some type of a direct, you know, direct to consumer neuro tool, and, you know, where do you draw the line where you're like, maybe I'll explore it. Maybe I'll back away.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting question. And I may mention someone asked that to me before once, and I was like, I mean, it kind of stumped me because I was like, I don't know, like, what would the trade-off be? Like, what sort of convenience would I get in order to have something implanted in my skull? And so I actually still don't have an answer. I mean, I can't think of what that would be, right? Like that would, I don't know if you, I mean, it's a good question for your listeners too.
Do
you have an answer for that? Either of you?
So my answer is that I am currently wearing an Apple Watch, right? And so apparently I'm okay with that because I do understand that they're just collecting data on me, you know, privacy or not, they're collecting data on me. And I see benefits from it. So I've been able to accept that, right?
You know, I trade off my privacy, right? And I mean, I have Alexa, I have Ring. I know all the,
we do these things, right?
Yeah. I'm aware of all the bad things.
You know, when we look at like, so Elon Musk's goal of having these primates be able to play computer games with their minds, you know, would you want to do that? If you had ALS, definitely. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's about the personal risk benefit trade-off, right?
Agreed.
So if you can't
But then there's Facebook's, you know, like, so you could text, you know, with your mind, right? Which to some degree, and you know, I wonder, you know, your thoughts on outside of neuro, but other sort of decision-making, cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, cognitive psychology aspects where people are trying to predict behaviors. You know, we see a lot of this in market research where ultimately we want to be able to predict if the person's going to purchase something or not, right? So it doesn't have to be an implant in your brain. We could collect all the other data from you and arguably make predictions about what you're going to do anyway.
Places like Target already are doing that all the time with purchase history.
I assume that market researchers know to some extent, like, or can find that out about, like, the way I browse a website or what I spend time, right? There's a lot that can be inferred about
right
behavior and what I'm going to do.
Because I sometimes argue that you would actually get better data just from watching me than if you were to read my EEG, because predicting behavior from EEG is a huge leap. Like, it's not there.
I've said the same thing, that like what you can tell from my phone, from my search history, from my GPS, you know, my email, which Google reads. And I know that I still use Gmail, right? So like,
yeah.
Or the little, does Facebook still put those cookies, like the cookies they put all around the internet to see where you're tracking? I mean, they track, everyone's tracking me and everyone's collecting data about me, and none of that data is like protected, and a lot can be inferred from it.
Yeah.
So to me, that's much scarier than anything that neural data, that EEG, I would say, can reveal, like in the near future, I would say.
Totally. If it ever gets to the point where, you know, a device could read your mind, which I am very obviously skeptical about that concept, all you're going to be seeing is how hungry I am all the time, you know, and how much I'm thinking about my next meal.
I mean,
it's the only big mystery, which I just spoiled. So there you go. But
you see that when I'm pulling up, like what time I'm pulling up Grubhub, or I'm thinking about getting my family dinner. Right. You know?
Absolutely.
You could know that from other data.
Exactly. So we touched on Elon Musk. I wonder, you know, as we come to the end of the conversation, what are some of the developments that you've seen recently that have really caught your eye or sparked your interest?
So I would say a lot of it. So there's two things. One is the consumer neurotech. So Elon Musk and his investment in neurotech is one of them, but he's just one player, and there's other, you know, very well-funded players in this consumer neurotech game. He's gotten the most attention, but, you know, the other ones are very interesting too. And they're, basically, you know, investing a lot of money in different sorts of, mostly I would say recording devices and devices that in theory could record and do some interpretation of the signals to allow some control for an external device. So can you use a wearable brain headset to be able to change the channel on the TV? Mm. There's one company that's doing something like that. And I think has a prototype and maybe it's selling it. I'm not quite sure, but using vision. But like, the other question is, do I want to wear that headset?
Yeah.
Right.
It evokes memories of me, of the movie WALL-E, where the people are in those pods, and they never have to leave the pod or move, and their muscles are like jelly.
Okay.
I recommend it. It's a kids movie too. So yeah, now that
little one's been too young, but I should
check it out. I do know what you mean though.
Oh no, I know WALL-E. Is that the one where there's like different emotions that move around?
Oh no, like, that's I know which one you're thinking of. That's a different Pixar movie.
It's another Pixar one. It's a very emotional movie. But no, WALL-E is like this robot that's on the wasteland that is the Earth. And all the humans have been transported up to a ship where they're just like in these pods watching TV. And they have like a Slurpee type drink that they drink all the time. But they wouldn't have to use a remote because their brain would just
think
about
it.
Yeah.
But with all that said, I can't believe, you know, talking to you, we could talk to you forever about everything, including WALL-E. But I do want to bring up, we do this game where we have, basically it's called React Attack, and we list off random words and then you just share the first thing that comes to your mind. It's basically a rapid fire free association exercise.
Sure, let's do it.
So are you ready? I have 10 words.
How does it go? You just say a word and I just say something.
Yeah, exactly. Say whatever comes to your mind.
Just like a word or a concept or...
You know, you know, when you think about traditional, like, you know, quick response, it's one word. But if you feel like doing a phrase, that's totally fine too.
Okay.
The real key is just to be
We're quiet. Not going
to
limit you.
Okay. All right. It's 10 words. And whenever you're ready, I will get started.
Okay. Ready.
Okay. First word, neurofeedback.
EEG.
Elon Musk.
Consumer neurotechnology.
Data privacy.
Neuro rights.
Mind reading.
I don't have a very quick reaction.
No worries. Bias.
EEG and recording bias and EEG.
Neuroethics.
International Neuroethics Society.
Metaverse.
I just got off a meeting with them, so Zoom.
And I believe I'm on my last word.
Yeah.
So the last word is going to be unorthodox.
Oh, movie.
Awesome. And, I'm going to be watching it. I want to see it now.
Now I'm going to go see it too. And we'll recommend everybody go see it.
That was an interesting react. Cause I thought it was going to be like, cause these are words that I say are just like, I see 1,000 times, like, or like words I see all the time. So there's not like one quick association cause it's so
broad. Yeah.
That's maybe something we should consider, like have more random words for people, like not the ones that they see all the time.
Like, yeah, I thought you were going to do like green
potato.
Yeah. No, that's what I thought it was going to be.
I don't want to scare people because sometimes I feel like if it's too broad, you know, but it's a good idea. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. For the people that are listening to this conversation and want to get in touch with you, do you have a way that people can connect with you?
Sure. In my website, wexlerlab.com. I'm also on Twitter. I'm not a super active tweeter, but I think it's @AnnaWexler. Or @Anna_Wexler.
All right. We'll be sure to have all the links. Don't worry. And are you on Facebook or not on Facebook? On LinkedIn?
Yeah. Yes. I don't really use it very much, but I'm there.
Okay. All right. So we'll recommend people to.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll recommend people to go to your website for the best way to contact you. But we just want to thank you so much for joining us.
As always, so much fun to talk to you. And for everybody listening, don't forget to like this video or podcast, however you're engaging with us. Follow and visit us on our websites or LinkedIn and get in touch with us, comment. And we'd love to hear from
Molly.
You. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
HCD Mindset is produced by Helen Ross. For more information or updates, follow HCD Research on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter @HCD Research Inc. And @HCD Neuroscience. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and be sure to rate, review, and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you and stay tuned for more curious conversations.